Our keynote this morning is the wonderful, fabulous Stormy Peters. She founded the open source program at Hewlett-Packard and has since moved on to join OpenLogic and is helping enterprises get open source, get it right, use it, be effective, etc. Without any further ado, please welcome Stormy Peters to the stage.
Well, good morning. Thank you guys for having me here. I've really enjoyed the conference. It is so awesome to be with such a large group of people that's really enthusiastic and passionate about what they're working on. That's what I try to take back to companies who want to use open source software. I try to tell them this is exciting, and there's a lot of people behind it. This has been an awesome conference, and I've been so impressed at the volunteers that run it. To run a conference with 700 people, with all volunteer staff, is something I think a lot of people think can't be done. So once again, the open source software community is showing that things can be done. So a couple years ago, I was at, I think it was OSCON. You know, to be honest, I can't even remember what the talk was about, but I was sitting in the audience, and the speaker said that she had read a study that if somebody did something for free, and then you paid them to do that, if you stopped paying them, they would stop doing it. And I just sat there, and I don't think I heard anything else that she said, and I just went, oh, shit. Because I help companies figure out how to pay the open source software community, how to hire open source software developers, how to, like, you know, funnel some of the commercial profits into open source to help open source software be successful. And I might, like, be killing the whole thing. And so I think I just kind of put it out of my mind for a while because I just couldn't think about it. And then I was writing a talk for EclipseCon, and it was a talk called How to Get the World's Best and Brightest to Work for You, and it was how to hire open source software developers. And this question kept creeping up. If they're doing it for fun and you pay them and you stop paying them, will they quit doing it? And so my talk actually ended up looking a lot like this talk, very different, but this is what I was talking about. So I went out and I did a whole bunch of research, I read a bunch of papers, I read books not on the topic, and what I want to share with you today is what I learned from the studies, and then kind of a couple, another additional aha that I had at the end. And I have to say, every talk I ever give is influenced by the audience. So at the end, there'll be time for questions and comments, and I'll be here through Saturday if you want to catch me. I always end up adding something to my talks the next time around from people that come and talk to me. So one of the studies that I read was about preschool kids. And so these were little 4 and 5 year olds. And the teachers told them that they were going to play with some special markers. It was actually a psychology experiment. And so they brought out some special markers, and the kids played with them. And then in one classroom that was playing with special markers, when they were finished, the teacher said, wow, those are really good paintings. You did a really good job. We have some special awards. And they handed out awards for the paintings done with the special markers. In the other classroom, the kids played with the special markers. And at the end of the playtime, they said, okay, we're done, and they packed up the special markers, and they threw away their paintings or put them in their desk or whatever kids do with thousands of pieces of art that they create. And then a couple days later, they brought the special markers back out. And in the classroom that had not gotten any special awards or any special attention, kids played with them. And when they asked why you played with it, they said, because they're fun. In the classroom that had received awards and kudos and been told what a great job they did, nobody played with the markers. And they said, why aren't you playing with the markers? And they said, well, there's no special awards. I thought, wow, that, I could see that applying to open source software. So let's look at another study with adults. Maybe it's different with adults. You know, we're not 4 anymore. So this experiment actually didn't start out as an experiment. Switzerland had a whole bunch of nuclear waste that they needed to figure out what to do with. And so they went to towns, and of course nobody wants nuclear waste in their town, and they went door to door, and they said, would you be willing to take this nuclear waste into your town? As a good Swiss citizen, we need to put this somewhere. Your country needs you. Will you take it? And about half of the people said that they would be okay taking this nuclear waste. They didn't like it, but, you know, it was their duty. So they thought, well, good. If we got half the people to agree to it, what if we add a monetary incentive? What if we start, you know, what we say, they picked a number, and it was about 6 weeks' pay, average pay, for the people in the town. And they said, then they went door to door, and they said, you know, it's your duty as a Swiss citizen to take this stuff, but we're willing to also give you a month and a half's worth of pay extra this year if you'll take this nuclear waste. And only 25% of people would take it then. For some reason, it was okay to turn down the payment. The fact that there was a payment made them ignore the fact that as a citizen they should do it, and they were able to say no to the paid offer. Kind of relevant to open source software. I got two more examples for you. New York City school kids aren't doing so good, I guess. And so this was last year, a year and a half ago. New York City started a new program, and they said that they would start paying kids to do well in school. So they paid for three factors. They paid for attendance, so you got more money if you went to school. They paid for taking the stupid standardized tests, you know, with all the little bubbles. So if you took the tests, you got more money. And then it was something tied to like grades and actual performance on the test. So there was some sort of performance metric to it. And kids could get up to $500 for going to school and doing well. And it got slammed in the New York Times by Barry Schwartz, who's the author of Paradox of Choice, and a professor of psychology at Swarthmore, cited all these studies and more and said, you know, you can't pay kids to go to school. You need to figure out why they don't want to go to school and make it fun for them to go. But if you pay them to go to school, you're going to have to pay them all the way through college, and then you're going to have to pay them to get fine jobs. And so I don't actually know how the study turned out, but I've heard nothing about it. So I have to assume it's not working well because there's been no big splash about how well New York City schools are doing in the last year and a half. The last one I'm going to talk about is a favorite of mine because it's something I encounter every day. There was a daycare in Israel, and they didn't set out to be a psychology experiment either. And they had a problem where parents were showing up late to pick up their kids. And then they'd say, come on, you have to come pick up your kids. We have lives too. We want to go home and see our kids. And parents were always late. And so they thought, well, what if we made them pay for this? So if you show up late, there's a fine. And I don't know what the fine was in Israel. At my daycare, it's $1 a minute. So you know, if you show up late, you'll have to pay a fine. What had, just like the first study I talked about, it had the opposite effect from what they wanted to have happen. Parents said, oh, good, babysitting. You organize the babysitter, it's the teacher my kid likes, and they would show up later and later. And they paid the fine, and you know they didn't feel guilty about showing up late because they paid the person to stay. And you can pay people to do a lot of terrible things, as anyone who sat through too many teleconferences can tell you. And so they said, okay, this isn't working. We really want to go home and see our families. And so they removed the fine. And people did not go back to coming back on time. They continued to be as late as they had been when they had got to pay for the privilege. They never went back to the original thing. And so while that's kind of a negative example, I wondered if that applied to open source software as well. So if you work on open source software, you get paid, you get laid off, company goes away, would you do it again? So we've got a whole bunch of open source software projects that are very successful, people that are very successful doing it that never got paid to do it or didn't get paid for quite a while. I had a whole bunch of slides to show you all the projects that were successful, but you guys know. There are projects out there that have not been monetarily funded that are very successful projects. And then these people got their dream job. They got a paycheck for working on this thing that they're willing to work on evenings and weekends for free. Now all of a sudden they're collecting a paycheck, and their spouses and families are much happier with them. Well, what happens if the company goes away, it's a .com, and it dies, or you get fired because you argued with your boss, or you hated teleconferences? Would you continue to do it? So just a show of hands. How many people here work on open source software? Can we call room? Okay, keep your hands up if you get paid to work on open source software. So maybe a third, I'm not good at this, but a third maybe. And then keep your hand up if you think you would continue to work on the same project if you lost your paycheck. Okay, and then how many people would continue to work on open source software, maybe a different project? Okay, thanks. So most people think they would continue to work on open source software, and I actually think you're right, I'll give away my punchline, but I think it would be a different project. So just, I thought about a third of you got paid to do it. The numbers that they've done on studies, it's about 40%. 40% of open source software developers actually receive a paycheck to work on open source software these days. And I think the study, a lot of this is in my blog if you're actually looking for the actual links, and I was going to write this whole up as a paper, it's not quite done yet. But it's about 40%, and there was actually another like 10 or 15% who receive a paycheck and work on open source software, but their manager doesn't know it. So I decided not to include those numbers. And so if you ask people, you know, if you no longer got paid, would you continue to do it? Most people say yes. And I thought, you know, what if it's like, you know, you see someone with a flat tire on the side of the road and you say, well, of course I would stop and help. But when you actually go to the side of the road, you know, 90% of the people just drive right on by. Done that myself. So let's not think about would you do it, but kind of would the whole community as a whole do it? Would the averages look like that? So in order to figure this out, you know, we have these psychology experiments, which keep them in mind as you're thinking about the different points. But what's really important is how can the company change a product? So about projects. So how, if a company comes in and starts paying developers or offering bounties, what are the different ways that they could influence it? And I came up with three main ways. The first one is you need to know what motivated the developers in the first place. You know, were they working on this project, speech recognition software, because their kid is blind, or were they working on it because it was really cool and whizzy? You know, what motivated them? It has to change the picture. And the second one is, what form of payment is it? So how is the company influencing the project? And then the third one is one I added at the end, after thinking about it a bunch, and it's, how does the company change the actual open source software development model? I'm just curious, how many of you that worked on open source software before and now have a paid job doing it, now go to many more teleconference meetings than you ever did before? I mean, so the company was changing the project, the way it worked. So the first one is what motivates developers. And there's actually been a lot of studies on this. And this is the one thing that's most confusing when I go into companies and I talk about open source software, and it always comes up at some point. They go, but why are these guys doing it? You know, why are they doing this in their evenings? Don't they have a life? And I've heard that from a lot of people. And I started out by trying to explain that writing software is fun. It's cool. You get to like solve problems and you get to see things happen. But there's actually studies that show why we might do it. And all of the studies started out thinking that there was some external reason why we did it. So you write open source software because you're trying to develop skills for a new job, or you're trying to get skills to get a promotion or get a pay raise, or your neighbors asked you to do it. They thought it was something external. But there's at least, I have four studies here. I know you can't click on the links because they're slides, but there's more of them. And all of them discovered that it wasn't an external reason. It was an intrinsic reason. It's something internal or something not motivated by the outside world. And I'll just go into them. So one of the reasons that came up is it's interesting. So people work on open source software because, you know, the same reason you'd read a good book. It's an interesting thing to find out about. It's an interesting thing to learn. And I'll bet there's some of you here that are trying to, like, follow the maze as you look at it. I mean, that's the type of person that goes into open source software. They find those things cool and interesting. They also discovered that, and this wasn't an open source software study that where this originally came from, but they went about figuring out what proponents make a job interesting. And they discovered that learning something new was the equivalent to a 20% raise. So if they offered two different jobs, and one paid more than the other, but it was doing the same old thing you've been doing for the past 5 years, and the other one was working in some cool new field, 20% pay raise was about the break-even point. Where you'd be more likely to do the learn versus the raise. Another reason people go into open source software is to feel creative. I've been to some talks today, this week, where I mean people are doing some really creative things. I tried to convince my boyfriend, but I went to a talk yesterday by John, where you know you can set your alarm so that the curtains slide across and open in the morning. That's a very creative solution. I went to a talk with Bito, where he was talking about making chips for his model rocket so he could like plot the, you know, how high it went and how fast it went. I mean, those are very creative solutions. And this is really key to my last point. I think this gets left out when companies get involved in open source software. And then there's a proverbial, why do people work on open source software? To scratch an itch. So your kid is blind and you really want them to be able to read what's on the screen and get involved in your computer world, so you write software that can read the words on the screen. Or you have a laptop and you have a DVD and you think that your DVD ought to be able to play in your laptop, and so you write a player to play the DVD. So this is really about, it's an internal reason because it's a need that you have that you're solving. And it solves things for lots of other people too, but you got started because it scratched your itch. And then another reason people go into open source software from these studies was for skills. And this isn't skills to get a new job. This is skills because it's fun to learn and be able to do new things. It's kind of like, you know, people take an art class or people take a carpentry class. People go out and, you know, check out that new project and download it and play with it to learn a new skill. And people go into open source software to show that they're clever. You know, when you're showing off your project and you're talking about it, you want to share with all your friends, wow, look at what I did. This is really cool. Look what I figured out. So it shows that you're clever. And then I had an issue with this one, but I'm including it. The study said that fame was an internal reward, and I really think it's an external reward. But one of the reasons that you go into open source software is to get recognition from your peer group. So in a way, it's fame and fortune. You know, you're really smart. You went all the way through high school. You went through college. And you know, I used to hide my report cards from my friends. Everyone didn't quite understand how cool it was to work on the computer. Now you have a peer group that recognizes it, and you can become, you know, famous for the skills that you have. And then I gave this talk at GuadEC, or a previous version of it, doesn't look anything like it. And a bunch of people came up to me afterwards and said, I work on open source software to do the right thing. You know, kind of the whole Richard Stallman mindset that all software should be open and available to everybody so we can make the world a better place by building on top of existing solutions. A lot of people came and told me that they work on open source software because it's the right thing to do. And they might not, that might be not the only motivation, but it's part of it. And so I went and looked at the studies, and it said that when they did polls of open source software groups, and there's been like no government study of it, so these are all, you know, surveys and people asking questions and doing interviews, but a third of the open source software developers that they talked to work on open source software because they think it's the right thing to do, or they believe software should be open. And to be honest, that number kind of surprised me. I thought it would be much higher. And I thought more people would be working on it because it should be open. So that's developer motivations. So now you know that, in case you didn't know why you're working on open source software, now you know or can put labels on them, or you can help try to explain it to your management or to your friends or to your spouse's friends or why you're doing this or you know why you just spent all weekend staring at your computer screen instead of playing outside. So the next area I thought that we needed to look at is payment. So you know, if you know why people do it, then how are they getting paid for it, and does that change whether or not they'll be demotivated by companies hiring them? So one of the studies that I read, and it's in my blog, this is the first point, two points, it depends a little bit on the field or the industry. I'm like, oh good, we're not all like daycares or preschool kids who would stop playing with special markers. They said it depends on whether payment is normal. So it's very normal to get paid to do software development. So it's less likely that payment to work on software will be demotivating because it's something you kind of expect. And so it doesn't change your internal way of thinking. On the other hand, if a church started paying people to come to church, it's so unusual to get paid to go to church that it might affect how they felt about it inside. Because, you know, you can be like, oh, well, I'm getting paid to go. And, you know, then when they stopped getting paid, they might quit because there's such a conflict in the way they saw going to church and that payment. The other thing it depends on if that paycheck or that bounty is tied to something, and the two things they had was performance or completeness. So for example, if you get paid in recognition or you get paid in information, so you know, a payment would be you went to your performance review and your boss said you're doing a really good job. That's not going to be demotivating. You're not going to stop working on open source software because your boss told you you did a good job. But if your boss said, the Linux kernel is too slow and I want performance up on our hardware by 200% by this time next year, that kind of goal is demotivating. So if you know you worked on it really hard and you got fired, you'd be less likely to try to continue on that project because it's kind of tied to that 200% performance thing that you may or may not have agreed with in the first place. The other demotivating thing is completeness. So it's one thing to get a paycheck to work on Samba or to get a paycheck to work on a project, and it's another thing to get a paycheck to have the project done. So that it's much more likely to change your motivation because they're paying for you to complete the project as opposed to paying for you to work on it for whatever reasons you had. Did that make sense? So then I thought, it matters if payment is normal in that field, and it's very normal in software. It matters if you're paying for completeness or for performance, and then it matters how you get paid. So the most common way that people get paid is employment. You get a paycheck to work on open source software. And I think if companies getting messed up in open source software, as far as the payment structure, this is probably the most benign. But I have my third point gets to this. And there's a lot of people in here that get a paycheck to work on the project. Another way is in kind. So it's giving you software or prizes or something to work on a project. So when One Laptop Per Child, when they handed out those laptops, that was in essence an in-kind payment for you to go off and write cool things for the One Laptop Per Child. When I was at HP, when we did a similar thing with PA Risk, so we went out and found all of the PA Risk hardware that we had and we sent it out to Linux kernel hackers so that they could make the Linux kernel work on PA Risk chips. Then there's bounties. I think bounties have been the most controversial one, but that's where OpenLogic is, so I'll explain how you get there. Bounties, so bounties is where you get paid. Someone wants a feature or something added to a project, and they put it out there on the web, and they say, you know, this is worth $500 if you add this feature. And I think the reason a lot of the bounty programs have not worked or have failed is because it requires a lot of project management work on the person putting the bounty out there to make it work. So, you know, you have to write up a really good spec of what you wanted it to do or how are you going to accept it. You know, what does it have to do? Then you need to make sure that, like, 10 people don't go off and do the same thing, because then you have to pay 10 times 500, and then which one goes into the project. And then when it's done, you have to decide if you're going to accept it or not, and to test it often requires as much knowledge of the project as if you just written it yourself. So I think that's the reason a lot of bounty programs haven't worked. At OpenLogic, we're doing it a little different. We support open source software for enterprises. We're trying to get enterprises to use more open source software, and we support 360 products. And what we do is we have people in the community that when there's a bug or an issue, we pay them to fix the bug and check it into the project. So the bug is fixed and solved, the issue solved by somebody actually working on the project and not us and then trying to get it back in. And it's been working so far, and as far as I know, nobody has like quit working on open source software because we're paying them. I did have a couple people that wanted to quit their day job to solve issues for us. And I said, well, the volume's not quite there yet. The other way, this is the last way that companies kind of influence or pay projects is through grants. So, you know, a company might say, I'm giving a grant of $1 million to a university to work on Linux on supercomputers. So it's giving a grant to another body to kind of organize a project around open source software. And so then I thought, well, does this all really apply to the real world? You know, I saw all those psychology experiments. I thought about how people were paid, what motivated them, and how they were paid. And at one point, the talk kind of ended here. And I thought I was really missing something. And so I thought, well, you know, maybe there's an example out there. I could just go find a project where this has happened. So is there a project where people have been paid to work on open source software, and then the project, you know, the funding went away? What did they do? Someone came up to me after the ClipsCon talk and said, well, Easel was kind of in that boat. Easel, you know, had this huge business model of, like, online storage and backup, and the company lost its funding. The project is still around. I don't really know what happened to all of the developers. I would bet that they're all still working on open source software. They're not all still on Easel, because Easel's smaller. But the question was, where did they go? So if you said you would stay in open source software, so like the Easel guys, where did they go? And I think they go on to work on other projects. So studies have shown, and the OpenLogic expert community shows, that people work on an average of at least 5 projects. Nobody works on just one thing. Maybe you're working on one thing at a time, but you know, you were working on that project, and then you saw this one, and you're working on it, and you kind of got your eyes on 2 or 3 others, and they're kind of related to yours. So I think if people stopped working on a project, they would actually go on to work on some other open source software project. I don't think they would leave the community unless their family was starving and they just had to go, you know, find a job in a whole different industry and become an attorney or something. But would it really be the same? I mean, they were working on that project and they got paid to do it. Even if funding didn't go away, when the company started paying them, did that project change? You know, is it different now? And that comes to my third point, and that's the open source software development model itself. I think when companies start paying it, they influence it, whether you like it or not. They're paying you for some reason to, you know, to work on that project. And I think that's the point that was missing. And the thing that's key, and I'll get to it, is I think design gets left out. So bear with me a little history here. this came from Dan Pink's book, but Thomas Friedman's also made the point, a number of authors, Seth Godin's blog kind of touches on this a little bit. So way back when, like Bruce said, we are optimized for hunter-gatherers. When we were hunter-gatherers not too long ago, we spent a lot of time finding food. We spent a lot of time finding food to eat, you know, picking apples off the tree or hunting animals, and everybody in a society was involved in the food process. Then we discovered agriculture, and so now all of a sudden you could plant fields, the food generation mechanism was much more efficient, and you could start feeding more people. Less people had to actually look for food in order to feed more people, and you started to get towns. So you had towns of people living together, and not all of them had to be finding food. So then you started to get jobs like accountants, because, you know, somebody's got to make sure that if you give me 2 bushels of corn, I really gave you 10 eggs, and, you know, that guy really, you know, babysat my kids while I was out in the field. And then, of course, since you had accountants, you have attorneys, because sooner or later there's going to be an argument about how many bushels of corn I gave him. So you had this, you know, attorneys came up, and then eventually we got to computers, and we got computer programmers. And now we have a society that supports a whole bunch of people that aren't involved directly in food production. And these people were all left-brain thinkers. They're very logical, very organized, very analytical. And up until very recently, our society has very much valued that left-brain thinker. I mean, if you look at attorneys and accountants and computer programmers, they hold very good salaries because being logical and being able to think like that is highly valued. And then along came open source software and Web 2.0 and, you know, all this new stuff. And I think we came to a phase that Dan Pink called creators, and Thomas Friedman doesn't have a label for it, but he talks about it, where open source software developers aren't just left-brain thinkers, they aren't just writing code, but they're out there thinking, like John said, my sprinkler system doesn't, you know, have a box to control it. Wait, I could go buy the parts and attach it to my computer, and I could control my sprinklers through my computer. So it's a whole new way of thinking and of looking at the world and coming up with creative solutions. So it's not just a left-brain, you know, tell me what to write and I can, you know, give me the spec and I can write it out, but it's more of creatively thinking of solutions to the problem. And I think this is where our society is going. We see much more companies, the newer companies coming out are very much customized products. You know, you put it on the web and people can pick and choose the pieces they want. When I go to Amazon, I don't have to go into the store and look at all just the best sellers. I can find all of those books that and they recommend them to me that are just interesting to me. And so when companies come involved, I think they leave out the design phase. They look at open source software developers, they're excited about open source software, they see what it's accomplishing, and so they want to get involved, and then they bring those people in, and they expect them to act like those left brain, just write code people. So people are working on open source software, they get their dream job, and then they get a paycheck for the company, and of course they're expected to participate in the company methods, they're expected to go to the teleconferences, they're expected to be on the mailing list that have like 10,000 people on each email, and they're expected to play in that world and represent the company's interest. And when you're collecting a paycheck, you want to do that, right? I mean, you took a job at the company because you thought they were doing cool things and you want to make sure their interests get represented. The problem is that then you end up with a project manager and a product manager and a technical architect who writes the spec, and all of a sudden they're telling you exactly what feature you're supposed to be adding and how. I was talking to Jacinta on the first night, and she actually had a friend who was told, you know, there's a problem in this code and it's between lines 8 and 10, you know, please fix it. So you're no longer being creative in designing, you're just writing code for a spec. So then you have, you know, these developers trying to be creative, trying to tell their management, wow, we could do really cool things, and you have management saying, but that we can't do it that way. You know, it doesn't work that way. We've built this, you know, multi-million dollar company doing it our way, and we're part of this open source software community. We know it's cool, but we have to continue to do business. And you get really frustrated. How many people in here have spent some time arguing with some manager in the past that there was really a better way to do it, or that they were ignoring something? Yeah. And I think part of it is the open source software model is very open. I mean, when you have a discussion about how something's done, it's on the mailing list. It's on IRC. And even if you don't participate, you can watch it, you can see the rationale, you know how it got there. And then you get to the company where it's decided in either the meeting you skipped, or the meeting that you weren't invited to because it was for product managers or project managers, and part of that process gets left out. And I have several friends that have quit jobs when they got to this point. So please don't quit your job, because there's just hope here. But I had a friend who was working on a project, and a customer called, real live person using their project, and had a bug that he knew how to fix, a problem that he could add a feature and it would fix it. And his manager said, no, you can't work on that right now. We have a release in 2 weeks, and we really need to get it out the door. So he came in over the weekend. I'm on his hockey team, so I know he was in there all weekend, and fixed, added the feature for the customer, fixed the bug. And when his boss came in on Monday, he told him, hey, look, I fixed the guy's problem. And his boss said to him, if you were working all weekend, you should have been working on what was important to the project, which was not that. And the manager was a friend of mine, too, and he was worried about his release and meeting all the other customers' needs that they had promised. So I don't think the people were the bad people. I think that the open source software isn't yet integrated into the way companies do business, and that's where we can all help. So you all are creators, and you need to bring that power to the company to show them that you need to involve all of the smart people from the very beginning of the process. The people writing the end code have to be involved in the what it's going to do, who's going to use it, how it's going to be used. All of that information has to be transparent through the whole process. We need to help corporations do the right thing. So I don't want you all to go quit. I don't want you to go tell your managers, this isn't how we should be doing it. I want you to think about how you did it in open source software, either before you got a paycheck or maybe now still that you got a paycheck, and what was cool about it, and how that design process worked and how those ideas got generated, and bring that into the company. Maybe have more of those design discussions on those big, massive mailings that you get with like half the world CC'd. Start having the design discussions there. Start bringing that process in. So we need to show them why open source software has been so successful. They know. They're excited about it. They're passionate about it. They want to be involved in that world. It's up to us to make sure that we don't lose a piece of that as we get incorporated into companies. So that's my talk. I have a shameless pitch. This isn't Pia and Jeff Waugh's Australian open source census. That's from the bottom up. This is, we're trying to help companies use open source software, and one of the things that we found is very effective is if you can tell them everybody else is doing it, they're much more likely to do it. So we're starting a project to, you go, you run a scan on your system, and you tell us what open source software we're using, and we're generating a big database to show what's being used where. So that was my shameless pitch back to the talk. I'm open for questions. I think if people come up here, we'll have a mic, and I'm open to comments, questions, suggestions. I'll try to repeat the question.
Software carpentry, they had a competition to produce a new bug tracker, a new make replacement, all paid for. It was a complete disaster. They selected them all, and nearly everyone involved went, I'm not working on this. I don't care. The fact that they were encouraged to come up with the design, but to not actually get the result. To actually not produce the actual result because they were being paid.
So the question was, had I looked at the software carpentry project? The quick answer is no. But it sounds like the project was a contest where people came up with designs for like a new bug tracker and whatnot, and then they wanted to pay for people to work on them, and people came up with the designs but then didn't want to work on them. That's interesting because
it's directly to the section.
Yeah.
I think we have a microphone.
Okay, I had an observation and then sort of an observation, a second observation I hope you can speak to, but the first is just that one method of losing open source programmers to industry is they start out as uni students usually or young people and they want to program, they love programming, so the only way that they can program with a bunch of other people is open source software. It's the only method available to them. Then they graduate, they get a job, they discover that it's actually programming they like. And they like programming in business nearly as much, maybe a little more. And so they just program whatever they're told to program, and they don't touch open source software again. So there's this sort of group of people who are just there because they like programming.
And I think that's okay. I mean, if they just like programming, I know there's some people that they just want to write the code. It's like a piece of puzzle. But I think that companies are losing out on the power of the open source model because they're losing the creative talents of those people when they do that.
And the other thing was whether or not for the community it would be useful. So there are some people who come to open source software because their boss tells them to. I'm told this is common in, I'm not in kernel development, I'm told this is fairly common in kernel development that some people just show up because their boss has said to them, we've got this bit of hardware, he's writing the Windows driver, you're writing the Linux driver, and we want to make a GPL and you've got to give it to the project. And I think for open source software, I don't know so much for companies, but it would be useful if we could keep these people. Once they quit their jobs, they almost always go away. And I don't know whether you've encountered that and whether you have any thoughts for the community on
how to keep those people that get paid to start. So that's the whole other angle, right? You don't lose them when they get paid, but when they get paid to do it, attracts them. I think some of them catch the open source bug and see that it's cool. So it would be showing that enthusiasm, getting them to come to like LinuxConf Australia, you know, getting them involved with the community on a more active level.
I know, like for a lot of programmers, it's like the scratching the itch, the coding stuff up that's fine or interesting new feature that you're interested that you want, is what motivates them. But then a lot of the other stuff doesn't get done or gets put on the back end. Like, you know,
like
documentation, testing, like packaging nicely, easy installation for users. Do you think it's perhaps more valuable for companies to be paying people to do all that extra stuff that's not fun, but someone needs to do to get a product rather than just a cool hack out to users, rather than focusing just on the people writing the cool software who probably be writing those cool features anyway?
So two things. There are actually people out there that think writing documentation is fun. I've met them. Now, for some reason, they haven't found the open source community in the same numbers. So if companies are willing to pay people to help with the parts that don't get done, I think that's all goodness, right? And I think they do to some extent. Is that kind of, yeah. But if we could get those people to actually think it's fun, and granted they're a minority, to come in and get involved, I think that would be awesome.
Your example before about the guy who came in for the weekend and programmed this one specific feature is good for small things when you know, okay, I know that exact piece of code very well and I can come and do it. How should a programmer approach the situation where they're working for a company and they can see a larger feature request for something that's going to be quite large that may need changing the company's direction in a way? What sort of things can a programmer at that low level do to talk to management and get that change happening?
Yeah, so first I'll paint my ideal world. In my ideal world, everyone would be involved and get to decide what they work on. And so the company would make it so transparent where they're trying to go and what their customers are saying that you would be able to see, either they would be able to see you were right or you would be able to see that they were right even though you really thought this was important, you were hearing other things. So that would be my ideal world. You'd get to work on what you wanted to, but you would have visibility to the strategy so that you could see what was important and they knew you would see that. On the short term, when I worked at HP, when I first started at HP, we had 20% of our time to work on whatever we wanted. And I think Google has a similar model. You get like, and someone from Google could probably say like a day a week where you get to work on, you know, time. And I think that model works well as sort of a transition point. So you get some time to work on your project and show that it's useful and real to the point where management can start seeing it.
If that's more than one developer can do, or
you know, you can talk your friends into it.
Okay.
it's a tough one, but I think there has to be some transition path.
Thanks, Stormy. I know you've done evaluation.
I thought you were going to boot me off the stage.
No. I have a question. Low numbers of women in this world. There are a lot more women writing. There are a lot more women writing code generally than there are women writing code in free software.
Absolutely.
There are a lot of women contributing to free software. I'm one. I write no code. Do you have any stuff to say and how this, because some of the stuff I've read says a lot of women are going home and looking after kids and stuff, and it's that free time element which is missing for them, and perhaps that's why we're not seeing so many in free software. Do you have any stuff to say on that?
Yeah, so I've actually given whole talks on where the women are. So if you look at the software industry in general, you can actually build a pyramid. Number of women in high school that are interested in math and science, number of women in undergraduate and college getting computer science degrees, PhD students that in computer science that are women, women in the field of computer science, and then women in open source software is 2%. So there's obviously a funnel channel problem here, because there's a lot of women that could contribute and could be part of it. I have heard that argument. I think I have a lot more guy friends who have lots of computers in their basement and go home and think they're cool and work on it. But I think that's a priority thing and expectation from culture. I also play with my computer and I get a little grief for it. But, you know. So I think there's definitely real challenges in it. I think you do find a lot of women in computer science in helping out, not writing code. You find a lot of women in community management. I gave a talk at Linux Chicks. Like half of the community managers that get paid by a company are female. And I kind of wondered why that is when only 2% of the developers are women. And I think one of the things we can do is call out those roles as role models for women in the technical field. So you say, women are here, make sure that they're visible so that they kind of feel welcome. But it's definitely a challenge, and nobody really has the answer.
So I don't really have a question, but a quick comment, and I'm going to try to make it very quick. I think what I heard from specifically that example...
Did you count my ums? You were going to count my ums.
I'm going to get to that later.
Okay.
Specifically the example about the guy who came in on the weekend to work on what he actually wanted to do versus what management wanted him to do, I think what we're looking at is a communication problem between tech people and management people. Now, this is actually what I do for a living. I sit between the two and I try to think, what does management do and what does tech people, what do they think, how do they work? And it's quite possible that in the open source world there are more people that can actually see both sides. So rather than concentrating on pushing open source into management, maybe we can create that layer in the middle. Try to understand management, try to understand tech, and then bridge between them, find the metaphors.
Absolutely. There's a communication problem, and I think there's a lot of people in this room that are good at that kind of thing. The other thing I think is it's a perceived you don't understand. So I think as far as we can make it, yes, I do understand, and make sure everyone's sharing the same goals goes a long way towards trusting people's judgment.
Can I just quickly see, would those people who think that they would be good at bridging between tech and management put their hands up? Wow.
Yeah.
Thanks.
This group, I think, open source software developers feel very empowered because you get to experience that. I saw the problem, I came up with a creative solution, and I wrote it, and that's very empowering. And so in general, I think the group feels more powerful. But I'm rambling, so I'll let you guys get back to the conference. And I'm around until Saturday, so if anybody wants to talk.
Thank you. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. 20 minutes.